I'll be reading three passages from Job today. The first one is Job 29, verses 1 through 6. The second is Job 30, 16 through 19. And the last one is Job 31, verses 35 through 40. Job continued his discourse, saying, "If only I could be as in months gone by, in the days when God watched over me, when his lamp shone above my head, and I walked through darkness by his light. I would be as I was in the days of my youth, when God's friendship rested on my tent, when the Almighty was still with me, and my children were around me, when my feet were bathed in curds, and the rock poured out streams of oil for me. Now my life is poured out before me, and days of suffering have seized me. Night pierces my bones, but my gnawing pains never rest. My clothing is distorted with great force. He chokes me by the neck of my garment. He throws me into the mud, and I have become like dust and ashes. If only I had someone to hear my case. Here is my signature. Let the Almighty answer me. Let my opponent compose his indictment. I would surely carry it on my shoulder and wear it like a crown. I would give him an account of all my steps. I would approach him like a prince. If my land cries out against me and its furrows join in weeping, if I have consumed its produce without payment or shown contempt for its tenants, then let thorns grow instead of wheat and stinkweed instead of barley." The words of Job are concluded. This is the word of the Lord.
Hey, everybody. Good morning. My name is Tom McGregor. I'm part of the lead team here at Imprint. Ken Moore, but also Imprint Woodinville and Bothell. And it's my privilege to open God's Word with you this morning. We have been in a series on the book of Job for the last 8 weeks. And I know for some of you, those have been suffering weeks, where you're just struggle bussing through this book on suffering. And that's understandable because, you know, Job is dark. But life can be dark, can it not? We all go through periods of difficulty, of suffering, or we go with other people through periods of pain and suffering. And so we have started this series on Job to look at the primary source in the Bible where an author spends concerted time on a particular topic, on the topic of suffering. And what we're looking at when we look at the book of Job, when you go home and read the book of Job later this week, what you're looking at is not just camera footage of something that happened a long time ago, but you're looking at this artistically crafted book of wisdom literature that is meant to provide comfort to those who suffer, wisdom for all of us so that we can suffer and suffer with others well, and then also a book that is meant to lead us into wonder, into awe before the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God represented to us by Jesus Christ, and that wonder would produce worship in our lives. And that's what this series is all about, is comfort, wisdom, and worship. Now, I want to catch you up on where we're at, because you just read these excerpts from this three-chapter section of Job's last words, Job's last stand. And if you aren't familiar with the story, it kind of just comes out of nowhere and has no context. And so let me give you a brief run-through of where we've been. We've seen Job is this perfectly righteous prophet and priest and king in the ancient Near East. He is a literary depiction of the ideal person who is in right relationship with Yahweh and right relationship with his neighbor. And God is really happy with him and is bragging about him in the heavenly courtroom scene. And then this shadowy figure called the accuser shows up and says to God, he levels an accusation. He says, "Job isn't righteous because you're beautiful and he loves you. He's righteous because you're buying him off. Of course he does all the right stuff. It's because you've given him wealth and you've given him comfort. And if you took all that stuff away from him, you'd see he'll curse you to your face." And so the accuser levels a formal accusation in the heavenly courtroom, and God says, "I actually think that you're wrong, and so I'm going to allow you to do all the things you've said, However, I'm going to limit your activity in Job's life. You can take away everything he has. You can take away his health, but you can't take away his life. And so the accuser goes out. Excuse me. The accuser goes out and takes away Job's wealth. He takes away Job's kids. All Job's kids die. And finally, he takes away Job's health, and he's covered from head to toe in these painful boils that are oozing pus, and Job is destitute. And he goes outside the city to the ash heap, and he mourns in dust and ashes, and yet he does not curse God to his face. Instead, he blesses Yahweh. He says, "Blessed be the name of the Lord." And his friends hear about it, and they come from a long way off to comfort him, and they show up, and they can't even believe it. And so for 7 days, they join him on the ash heap in silence. After this, Job can't handle it anymore. 7 days of silence is a long time. And he cries out, and he says, "I wish I'd never been born. I wish I was dead. None of this makes any sense. I don't understand." And this is very shocking to his friends and actually a little bit offensive. And so they can't help but speak back, and they start accusing Job. Initially, they had come to provide comfort, but now they're offended. Their religious sensibilities have been offended. And so they say, you know, we all know from ancient wisdom, from special revelation, dreams, we've had these experiences. We know that if you do the right things, you get blessing. And if you do bad things, you get cursing. And since you look like you've been cursed, we think you've done bad things. And Job says, absolutely not. And so from chapter 4 to chapter 27, there's these three cycles of dialogues where a friend named Eliphaz will speak, and then Job will say, no, you got it all wrong. And then a friend named Bildad will speak, and he'll accuse Job, and Job will say, no, that's not me, I swear it. And then a friend named Zophar will speak, and Job will be like, you got it all wrong. And this goes on for three cycles, and they just get nowhere. The friends are spinning and devolving, and the dialogue is much more like a series of accusations and failures to achieve wisdom. And Job, meanwhile, he's progressing. He's growing in strength. He's growing in wisdom. He's growing in confidence that there is something wrong with the system because he has been righteous. But his circumstances do not indicate that that's the case. And he doesn't know what the answer is, but he knows that the friends aren't right. And so the narrator drops in a poem to wisdom in chapter 28, and he says, look, humans strive, they dig, they're looking for valuable and beautiful things, but they can't find wisdom. God alone knows the way to wisdom. He possesses wisdom. And then the poem concludes by saying, here's what wisdom is. It's to love God and to turn away from evil. And then we get Job chapter 29 through 31. Now, Job chapter 29 through 31 is outlined like this. Job in chapter 29 says, I wish things used to be the way they used to be. Like, I wish things were the way they used to be. He laments the loss of the blessing that he had. Chapter 30 is, but now things are terrible. Things used to be great, but now they're awful. And he talks about how terrible they are. And then in chapter 31, he basically brings his evidence to God and demands a hearing. It's a courtroom scene. So there's things used to be great, chapter 29. Things suck right now, chapter 30. And chapter 31 is, I want a trial. Now, in 1946, there was a German Lutheran pastor named Günter Rutenborn. He's from Berlin. He'd been a part of the Confessing Church in Germany. He'd opposed the Nazi regime, and he had assisted many Jewish people in escaping the death camps and escaping the persecution of this wicked empire. And when the war was over, he was, like the rest of Germany, trying to reckon with what had just happened. And so he wrote a play called The Sign of Jonah that is also a trial. And it's about people trying to figure out who is to blame for what just happened. There was another man from, actually, I believe he was from Austria. His name's Elie Wiesel. You're probably more familiar with Wiesel than Günter Rutenborn, because he wrote great books like Night and several others. But he also wrote a play that was exploring this theme of who is responsible for the injustices of our world. Who is responsible when things go bad? And his play was not entitled The Trial of Jonah, or The Sign of Jonah. It was called The Trial of God. And you can imagine who goes on trial. So we're about to enter into a courtroom scene, and what we're going to see is the evidence Job presents in chapter 29. He's going to build a case. And for us, what he shows us is that there's always something. There's a record that each of you want. Each of you are building a case in your life to achieve this record. But that when suffering enters in, there's this cosmic dissonance between the case you thought you were building and your experience. So we're going to see the record you want, the silence you can't endure, and finally in chapter 31, we're going to see the righteousness or the record you really need. So I'm going to kind of walk us through in the next 25 minutes this passage and show you those three things. In chapter 29, Job continues his discourse and says, "If only I could be as in months gone by, in the days when God watched over me, when his lamp shone above my head and I walked through darkness by his light, I would be as I was in the days of my youth, when God's friendship rested on my tent, when the Almighty was still with me and my children were around me, when my feet were bathed in curds and the rock poured out streams of oil for me." All of the friends said, "Here's the problem, Job, you've sinned. Your record is bad, and so you've got a bad result, right? You're being cursed. If you repent and confess to God and say, 'Yeah, I totally blew it, I'm so sorry,' then he's going to give you all your stuff back." But what's the problem for Job? When he says things used to be awesome, he doesn't say, "I had all this money, I had all this power, I had all this privilege, I had these beautiful kids." The record that he has lost is intimacy with God. He talks about the days when God watched over him, when he walked with him, when God's friendship rested on his tent or on his house. The record that Job is lamenting losing is friendship with God, intimacy with God. He talks about what proceeds from that intimacy. He says, "When I went out to the city gate and took my seat in the town square, the young men saw me and withdrew, not because they were afraid, but because of honor. While the older men stood to their feet, city officials stopped talking and covered their mouths with their hands, presumably because Job was so wise and they'd rather listen to him than keep on. The noblemen's voices were hushed and their tongues stuck to the roof of their mouths. When they heard me, they blessed me, and when they saw me, they spoke well of me." So Job has this incredible status and honor in his community. He's built this record, and where does that status and honor come from? It's not because he's wealthy. It's not because of his kids. It's because of his character. He says, "For," in verse 12, "I rescued the poor who cried out for help, and the fatherless child who had no one to support him. The dying blessed me, and I made the widow's heart rejoice. I clothed myself in righteousness, and it enveloped me. My just decisions were like a robe and a turban. I was eyes to the blind and feet to the lame. I was a father to the needy, and I examined the case of the stranger. I shattered the fangs of the unjust and snatched the prey from his teeth." It's a beautiful picture of Job's righteousness, and he's building a case in this courtroom drama. "I have been very, very loyal to Yahweh, and that loyalty in friendship has proceeded into social justice. I have done right by my neighbor. I have done right by the vulnerable." He has a holistic righteousness, not just a private and personal morality, but a holistic righteousness that proceeds from his relationship with God into every sphere he has influence in. It's not superficial. It's not just keeping rules. It's mercy and generosity and loyalty. And if you read chapter 31, you'll see the depth of it. He makes a covenant with his eyes. He refuses to lust. He refuses to exploit. He refuses to trust in wealth or to practice idolatry. It's this incredible picture of Job's righteousness. And he's building this case up. Now, the friends have said, if you do bad, bad things will happen to you. And if you do good, good things will happen to you. And throughout, we've nuanced that in the dialogues. But here you can see that's actually what Job believes too. He says, it doesn't apply to me, but in general, that's what I used to believe. Because in verse 18, he says, so I thought, I'll die on my own nest and multiply my days as the sand. You know, I'll die after a long period of time. I'll die at home in my nest, comfortable. My roots will have access to water, and the dew will rest on my branches all night. My whole being will be refreshed within me, and my bow will be renewed in my hand. Which is some poetic language to talk about his legacy. Right? He's going to live a long life. He is going to leave this righteous legacy that will be like a tree of life and like a weapon against injustice for those that follow after him. See, Job's basic assumption was friendship with Yahweh, friendship with God produces righteousness, that is love of God, love of neighbor, social justice in all spheres. And the end result is blessing. That's what he believed. And that's what the friends believed. And the truth is, that's what you believe too. Each one of us in here believe that if I do the right things, if I work hard, if I obey the rules, the end result will be blessing. Now, some of you are like, no, that's not me. That's not me. But let me ask you, when you look at the scale and are aiming for a particular number, and you are giving up time and energy and resources to produce a body that is desirable, the process is like you think you're going to get a particular result, right? And it's so that you will be enough, so that you'll be worthy of other people's love, admiration. It's so that you'll be enough for them, that your efforts to produce that result would be enough. Or when you give up everything to pursue a particular vocation, to accumulate knowledge and skill so that you are able to do well, to the neglect of everything else, family and friends and balance in your life, you're trying to be enough. You think that if you can just put enough effort in, it will produce an end result that is enough for you, and it will result in you being seen by others as enough. Your basic assumption is that if you work hard enough, you will be enough. I mean, we could go on. Like, why do you send your school kids to the right kind of education so that they will be enough? And why do you have such strong feelings about the only good education is public school or private school or homeschool? You're trying to be enough. Why do you spend so much time accumulating a diet that is only of the most pure things so that the only things that enter your body are purity, so that you can be enough, so that you're the kind of person that is enough? See, we're all trying to be enough. We are all trying to prove that we are enough to other people, that we would be worthy of their honor, love, respect. And we're all doing things we think will produce that end result. But at some point, those things contradict that belief about what is enough. At some point, you're not enough. Either your social circles will exclude you and you'll realize they didn't actually see you the way that you wanted them to, or a time of deep suffering will occur where all of your efforts haven't been enough. And that's exactly what happens to Job. The belief that if I do the right things, I will get the right result, that I will be enough, collides right into reality, into the suffering. And he says, but now, Job 30, verse 1, he says, but now they mock me. Men younger than I am, whose fathers I would have refused to put with my sheepdogs. So the very people that Job has spent his life helping, assisting, the people who are the lowest of the low, the outcasts of society, the vagrants and the criminals, have become people that see themselves above Job. His public honor has been inverted into public humiliation. He thought he was enough, but this suffering has proven that that's not the case. In Job 30, verse 11, he says, the reason why this has happened is because God has loosened my bowstring and oppressed me. They, that is the people that are mocking him and scorning him, have cast off restraint in my presence, but it's because God has become my adversary. In verses 16 through 23, he talks about how God chokes him by the neck. And in verse 19, he throws me into the mud. And in verse 20, he says, I cry out to you for help, but you do not answer me. In verse 21, he says, you've turned against me with cruelty. You harass me with your strong hand. And he concludes in verse 23 and says, I know that you will lead me to death. Job thought he was enough for his culture, for his society, for himself, but also for God. And now he feels like God is persecuting him, that God has become his enemy. And that dissonance between what he believed and what he's experiencing is causing a real problem for him. In your life, when you are trying to be enough for other people, be enough to achieve the end goal, whether that's relational or social, vocational, when you're trying to be enough and you realize all of your efforts have proven to be futile, you really kind of run into one of two things. You can either practice the religious try harder thing, right? You're trying to manage God by being good enough, or manage other people by being good enough for them. You try harder, you redouble your efforts, you find out what you did wrong so that you can change your behavior. In Isaiah 58, God captures this religious tone when he mocks Israel's refusal to do social justice, but intention to practice religious justice. He says, why have we fasted and you don't see it? They're like, yeah, we oppress the poor, we do all the bad things, but don't you really just care about the heart? And we're doing the religious stuff, we're fasting, we're praying, we're doing all the stuff that we think you want. And God's like, I don't really care about that if you don't see that love for me connects with love for other people. So when we run into that dissonance between what we think will make us be enough for others and our actual experience where we realize we're not, we can try harder. We can practice religion or irreligion. Kind of travels the opposite path. So if you take the image of the courtroom scene, irreligion rejects the judge and leaves the courtroom, to stretch a metaphor. It says, God isn't fair. None of this stuff makes sense. I'm out of here. And in effect, what you're doing is you're putting God on trial. In Elie Wiesel's play, what happens is that Ellie in Buchenwald at 16 witnessed this trial that just scandalized him and stayed with him for the rest of his life. He said there were rabbis, there were scribes, there were prisoners in this death camp, and they had come together on an evening to hold a trial, and they put God on trial. They said, why is all of this terrible stuff happening to us? Why are you allowing the Nazis to rule? Why are you putting children and women and innocents into these camps? And they put God on trial in Buchenwald, and a young Elie Wiesel witnessed these people condemn God. They marshaled the evidence against him, and the rabbis, even a priest, this community of prisoners put God on trial, and they condemned him. And what's really interesting, though, is as good religious people, at the end of the trial, at the end of the condemnation, one of the rabbis, after a period of silence, finally spoke up and said, well, it's time for evening prayers. Which, I don't know, to some extent, that's a beautiful picture of faith, where we realize there's something wrong with the system, and if God is in charge of everything, to some extent, he's to blame. And we condemn him, but then where else do we have to go? So Ellie wrote this play, actually in the 70s, called The Trial of God. He said it in the 1700s after a pogrom, but it was all based on this real life experience he'd had where a group of people put God on trial and said, you're the problem. But that's not what Job does with that dissonance. He doesn't try harder. He doesn't do the religious thing. He doesn't try to be enougher, but he also doesn't put God on trial, you know? Instead, he stays in the courtroom. And so in chapter one, he lays out the evidence in this trial. And if you read through it, it's really incredible. I summarized it up here for you. He talks about his sexual integrity. He talks about honesty in business. Again, he talks about sexual integrity within the context of his marriage. He talks about fairness in court, social justice, with a whole slew of different types of people. His loyalty to Yahweh over money or over idols. And he talks about his love for all. And if you want a one-stop shop for what it looks like to be a righteous person, Job chapter 31 is probably the best place I can think of where it's like, yeah, this is what social justice looks like from a Christian perspective. This is what being a righteous boss looks like. This is what being a righteous husband, this is what a righteous parent looks like. You've got this whole, of course it's poetry, so maybe for Western people it's not the best one-stop shop. But if you like poetry, I commend it to you. But he also isn't just talking about his behavior. All of this proceeds from his heart, from his relationship with God. He says in chapter 31, he talks about his heart. He talks about in 31 verse 23, how God's majesty prevents him from doing anything that would hurt God or hurt others. In verses 24, 25, and 27, he talks about his confidence. He talks about what brings him joy. He talks about what might entice the heart. So all of this stuff isn't just Job being a good guy and doing the right things. It's that relationship with God has so captured Job's heart that it's led to a beautiful picture of righteousness. And so while we're all building a case for what would make us enough for ourselves in our own estimation, or what would make us enough for our community, at some point you run into the problem of what makes you enough for God. And this would be a picture of what Job thinks makes him enough in God's eyes. It's interesting that throughout this, he keeps on bringing down a curse on himself. Actually, four times. He says, if I have done anything wrong, let it come back on me. If I have exploited the poor in court, let God not hear my protests in our trial. Or if I have ever gone after another man's wife, let my wife grind for another, like a mill, like she'd serve or sleep with another man. So it's this formal, I am righteous and blameless, but if I can be found guilty, this would be the consequence of my sin. And finally, he gets to the end. He says in verse 35, if only I had someone to hear my case. Here's my signature, let the Almighty answer me. Let my opponent compose his indictment. I would surely carry it on my shoulder and wear it like a crown. I would give him an account of all my steps. I would approach him like a prince. He's so confident that he has been enough, that he is calling down curses on himself if he's not, that he is asking God to participate in a formal trial. But he doesn't put God on the stand. He doesn't put God on trial. He puts himself on trial. I think this is something that only a righteous person could do. But I also think that it's not enough. Because remember, Job is, you know, probably based off of a real historical figure who had some real historical pain and et cetera. But Job, the book, is a literary depiction of a thought experiment that's supposed to lead to wisdom. And so the Job of the Bible is different in my eyes than the Job of history. And the Job of the Bible is perfect. The Job of the Bible has never done anything wrong. Outside of Jesus, Job is probably the only guy that comes off sinless in the entire Bible, which is really, I mean, honestly, a little bit scandalous to most people. But you're not. You're not sinless. And for you to put yourself on trial before a God who can say with pretty easily. Like, well, what about that? What about that? What about that? What about that? You know, like, you can't put yourself on trial. Ecclesiastes 7:20 says, there is certainly no one righteous on the earth who does good and never sins. And Romans 3:10, quoting Psalm 14, says, there is no one righteous, not even one. And then Romans 3:23 says, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. The glory of God is your purpose. Because the story of the Bible says that we were created to image God. Our vocation was to participate in his rule of his good world. That we were created to be a reflection of his character. And so for every rebellion, even the smallest one, we've damaged not just the mirror, but we've damaged the relationship. And so you can't put yourself on trial. You have no case. All of those things you've tried to collect that prove that you're enough might work for yourself. It might work for some other people. But ultimately, it fails in the courtroom of God's perfect justice. Every time that you've looked at somebody as an object for personal gratification, every time you've fudged the numbers to your gain, every time you've fudged the truth to save somebody the pain of knowing the real truth, you know, like every single time it damages the relationship and we fall farther and farther and farther away from that glory that God intended for us. And it moves us further and further away from the relationship that he created us for. Jesus in Luke 17 says, let's just say that you are perfect, that you never did anything wrong, that every single moment of your life was flawless. He says, when you've done all that you were commanded, you should say, we're unworthy servants because we've only done our duty. See, even all of the things, all the religious stuff, even the social justice that you practice, every good work that you try to do is ultimately just what you were created for. And when you try to use those things as a way to accumulate a case, evidence, a record that proves that you're enough, if that's what you're trying to do, then you're just exploiting other people. You're trying to extract enoughness from them or through them. And so if your good works are a means by which you prove to God that you are enough, you have used somebody else, you've exploited somebody else for your own gain, which just ruins the whole thing. Like, the secret we all know inside is that we were created to be enough, and yet we fall short, that we are not enough. And we spend our lives chasing this idea that if we just try harder, then we'll be loved, then we'll be accepted, then we'll be enough. And it's exhausting. It's absolutely exhausting. What we need is freedom from having to prove we are enough. We need somebody to say, you're actually enough, you're innocent. We need somebody else to take the hit. And that's what happens in Günther Rutenborn's play. Günther Rutenborn was that Lutheran pastor in Germany. And in 1946, okay, so like if you know your World War II history, 1946, he writes this play. Germany has just, the war's just ended. Germany is going through a national reckoning of who is responsible for all this kind of stuff. And Rutenborn looks at the national reckoning and he's like, somebody has to pay for what we've done. Somebody has to take responsibility. And so he creates a thought experiment, much like Job. And what's really interesting is in the play, it is real people that were involved in Nazi Germany that are the character actors. And they wear this weird, like, I can't really tell based off of the play directions, but it seems like they wear a veil over their face, so you can't see their true identity. And so when they're doing the action, it's like a bunch of veiled faces. But then when they talk to the audience, you can see that's the stormtrooper. That's the grocer that turned my neighbor in. That's the woman that hung the Nazi flag outside her door. And then they'd go back into the play. And what happens is the actors are the common man and the common woman. It is the officer and the SS stormtrooper. And it is even actually a representative of Germany. They call her the Queen of Babylon to represent the city, which I don't have time for. It's a great play. It's worth your time if you can track it down. And if you can't, I have a copy. And one by one, they start at the common man, the common woman, and they all give justification for why, like, what they did was appropriate. They didn't have any other option. I was just following orders. And so they kick the accusation up the level. Who's responsible for this? Yeah, I killed a bunch of people in the death camp, but I was just following orders. Yeah, I was a Nazi sympathizer, but what else was I supposed to do? If I didn't hang the flag, like, my neighbors would have accused me of being opposed, and then I would have died. So what was I, you know? They're justifying themselves. They're trying to prove, I'm enough. I'm okay. I didn't have any better options. I'm clear. It's not my fault. And so they kick it up and kick it up and kick it up and kick it up until even... So everybody gets cleared. Everybody is like, okay, you're innocent. Okay, you're innocent. Until we can find somebody else to take the fall. They kick it up to Hitler, and even Hitler is declared innocent. Till finally they all realize the only one that is ultimately responsible for all of this is God. And so, like the trial of God, they put God on trial. But the ending is very different. Because... in this play, you get a verdict of guilty, but you also get a sentence. And Rutenborn crafted this sentence that the people of Nazi Germany in 1946, metaphorically, condemned God with, and they condemned him like this. God shall become human, a wanderer without rights, homeless, hungry, thirsty. He shall know fear. He shall be born not in splendor, but along a road, under suspicion as a Jew and into poverty. All of the things they had said were guilty of, they heaped on to God. Just like Job says, if I'm guilty of this, I'll take the curse. The cries of the poor shall ring in his ears without relief. He shall walk among the diseased, the despised, and the forgotten, and rotting corpses will block his path. He'll love and be rejected. He'll speak truth and be misunderstood. He'll gather friends and be abandoned by them. He shall know what it means to lose a son and to suffer the anguish of fatherhood. He shall sweat in agony. He shall feel the weight of accusation. He shall be disgraced, ridiculed, executed, and he will die. And then when the heavenly messengers receive the verdict, they don't protest. So you've got three angels that show up to carry the verdict to God and let him know you've been condemned to die. But Gabriel instead says he'll go to a virgin named Mary. Michael says the heavenly host will not intervene, that God will walk the earth unprotected. And when he falls to his knees in anguish, strength will be given him only enough to continue suffering. The one who was truly innocent did not demand a document like Job, but he submitted to the verdict. See, I think what Job couldn't have done at this point, but that each of you are able to do, and it may sound irreligious, it may sound scandalous, but for all of those failures, all of those rebellions, all of those things that actually prove you are not enough, you can take those things and you can take them to the courtroom and you can put God on trial and you can say you are guilty of these things. But there's only one way to do that without being somebody that curses God to his face. 2 Corinthians 5:21 talks about Jesus and says, he made the one who did not know sin to be sin for us, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. See, Günter Rutenborn is a Lutheran pastor. He knows his Bible. And the condemnation that the people heaped on God actually fell to his son, Jesus Christ. And Jesus Christ came to earth. He came as one of us, as a human. And he lived all of those things that the people condemned God with. He was born in obscurity. He was abandoned by friends. He was constantly told he wasn't enough. And then he was crucified on a cross. And he said he did it for you. That all of those things you have failed to do that prove that you are not enough were carried by him as the indictment Job said he would wear like a crown. And they were absorbed by his death on the cross. And that instead of all of those things that prove you're not enough, he gave you his righteousness. That's what 2 Corinthians 5:21 says. We might become the righteousness of God. This is what theologians call imputed righteousness. What it means is, in God's eyes, he has given you the status and record of his son. And so that you are already enough in Jesus Christ. If you trust him, if you trust that his death was for you, and that God raised him from the dead into new life, and that he wants a relationship with you, then God has already declared you are righteous. You are enough. Romans 4:4-5 says, now to the one who works, pay is not credited as a gift, but as something owed. All of those things you're trying to use to prove you're enough, that doesn't work. But to the one who does not work, but believes on him who justifies the ungodly, his faith is credited for righteousness. See, it's that faith exchange. It's the trust of receiving what God has declared. So that now, if you have that kind of relationship, you are free from trying to build a life that proves you are enough. You're free from trying to extract enoughness from or through other people. And now those can be a kind of relationship where you have received and you freely give. Romans 8:1 says, therefore, there is no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. No condemnation. Before God, you are enough. But like Job, your enoughness doesn't just stop with you with nice religious feelings. What happens with the gospel is that it transforms you as you perceive this God who willingly took the verdict you deserved, who willingly entered into your pain, who willingly absorbed the cost of all of your rebellions, is that it changes your heart. You start to love different things. You start to love differently. And so you are free to not extract enoughness from your kids. You're free not to extract enoughness through your relationships. You're free not to extract enoughness from those you do justice with or to. See, there's nothing to hide if you're already declared enough. And this is the good news of the gospel, that in Jesus Christ, you are enough. Let me pray. Father, we are grateful that you say in your Son, we are enough. It is scandalous that you would willingly be put on trial for us. But it is good news that the death of Jesus Christ is not the end of the story, and that we have life to look forward to in his name and in relationship with him. I pray that you would help us to internalize this gospel, to really believe that you think we are enough and that you relate to us if we are enough, and that would free us from trying to extract enoughness from others. Pray now as we turn to you in the response that you would speak to us, that you would meet us where we're at, and that you would declare that you love us in the ways that we need to hear most. Meet with us now. Amen.